Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle.
So I saw a great video on YouTube, guys. Have you ever heard of the How It Should Have Ended series?
Yeah.
Well, I suppose you would have because I sent you the link.
Well.
I have now.
That's the YouTube series where people take movies that didn't end as well as they should have, and they kind of animated their own endings and how it should have been done. And they did one for Pacific Rim.
So you know how the movie should have ended.
Exactly. And it was I think I'd heard it somewhere before, where you kind of sit the big Jaegers outside of the rift and then just cut them apart as they emerge.
Right.
It's a pretty good idea.
I believe it was Dog Pile on them. Or Whale.
Yeah. So, yeah, you guys weren't alone in your ending ideas.
Well, so as if we haven't ranted about Pacific Rim enough.
There's more.
Yeah, there's more.
But wait.
For the low, low price of free, I saw online that someone proposed the Mako Mori test. Not as a replacement to, but kind of to work alongside the Bechdel test to kind of gauge female representation in movies. And for those unfamiliar, the Bechdel test pretty much has 3 points. It's, are there two named female characters who talk to each other about something other than a man? And there's debate on whether the conversation can have other things in it or how long the conversation has to be. But not getting into that, the Mako Mori test is there at least one female character who gets her own narrative arc that is not about supporting a man's story? So for those of you who don't know, Mako Mori is the pretty much only female character in Pacific Rim. She's the main character, the co-pilot to the main guy. And there's a lot of buzz about what a strong female character she was. And that's probably how this test came about.
Well, was she?
No. Like, Lyle and I were talking about this, and I really do not understand why people are saying she is a strong female character. Fair enough, she passes her own test. I guess there's a narrative arc there. It's not a very big one, because in my opinion, she just goes from, you know, kind of whiny, subservient nobody to whiny, subservient nobody. Mm-hmm. But other people have said there's growth there, so I guess she passes her test. But why she's getting called a strong female character, I don't know.
We had one theory when we were discussing it, and that was that they think she's a strong female character because she's Japanese.
Mm, yeah.
And we would just propose, imagine if she were a North American woman, or a European woman, and imagine that woman being as submissive as that character was in the movie, and speaking in that way, and being that deferential to the other characters.
Right.
Then ask yourself again, is that a strong character? Yeah, maybe it's because they think, you know, it's a culture thing, so you think she's very much playing up the culture.
But then that gets into the other point of how people were sort of praising the Mako Mori character for not being a Japanese stereotype. When I watched that movie, that's all I saw. All I saw was a Japanese stereotype. The stilted English, the deference to people because of rank or respect, the stupid little bows, you know, when people would come in, the use of, I guess, broken Japanese. So, again, not a strong female character, and pretty much only a Japanese stereotype from my perspective.
Did she kick a lot of butt?
She does some physical stuff. I'm a little bit disappointed because I don't think the actress put in the time in the gym to carry that off. So when they take off the shirt and you don't see that muscle definition, and then they start kicking ass, then it is a little bit disappointing.
Okay. Well, I was wondering if like maybe that's what some people meant by strong.
The only kind of fighting she does is during, spoiler here, during the pilot testing thing where her and the main character spar, and that's kind of it. And someone pointed out something interesting, like pretty much when she's in the cockpit with the main character. She pretty much doesn't say anything. Hmm. And I saw someone say, oh, that's because, you know, she's so strong, she doesn't need to say anything. And I'm like, oh, what? Again, that didn't come across.
Lame sounding
excuse. Yeah, exactly. That is a very lame excuse. It does not come across. And I completely agree with Lyle. If you put a North American woman in her place, or like a Caucasian or like an African American woman in her place, and did that, I'm sure people would be criticizing her character as incredibly weak. But it's that stereotypical honor Japanese thing that people are saying, oh no, she's such a deep character because she wants to do that, but you know, she's honor bound to do that. And I'm like, bull crap. So,
you know, when Wayne said, I agree with Lyle, I was like, what? I said something?
All right, I'm done.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
I agree with Lyle in spirit. The spirit of Lyle.
Because that's all we've heard so far this episode.
I don't know if it was Lyle or just me speaking in a slightly different voice.
Those vibes you're giving off, I'm totally in agreement.
All right. Yeah, so... yeah, let us know if you agree with Wayne on the Makomori test.
Or, air quotes, Lyle.
Yeah.
All right, for this episode, we're going to be launching a new series that we're calling Inspirations, because we weren't inspired enough to think of a better name. And the idea behind this series is if we find something in an other media that we think could be good for a game, and we're just going to share that. It's probably the ideas are not something that you can build an entire episode around, so we would save these for our inspirations episode.
All right, well, I guess I'll go first. I got Princess Mononoke, and this one is actually a very, very old inspiration, but it's kind of one that never really got off the ground, so it was one that I'd thought about for a while and figured that you guys might have a fresh look at it. It's actually right after I saw the movie Mononoke with another friend of mine who was a gamer. This is back in the States, when years and years ago when it first came out. But it was the idea that in the movie, there is kind of a kind of magic, you know, with the demon possession that the main character, Ashitaka, has. And also with the demon possession that the different animal gods have, that when they get emotional, and specifically in the movie, angry, kind of that's what draws the magic out and allows them to do superhuman feats. So the thing that was interesting to me and to my friend at the time was the idea of, it's kind of a cheesy name, but a rage mage, kind of where magic in a system is tied to emotion.
Out of curiosity, because that was Princess Mononoke is a good Miyazaki movie. I think it's my favorite one.
Mm-hmm.
And tangent, but I don't know how people think that movie is for kids, but anyway.
No, it ain't.
No, it isn't.
Actually,
it
is tangent-wise, but I remember being in the theater, and it was one of the first animes to open theatrically in the U.S., and of course, being a quote-unquote cartoon, all these families showed up with little kids, and I remember a scene where he's like, the main character's riding by, and he beheads two samurai in a row.
Yep.
With this gigantic daikatana, and like blood spurting everywhere, and I remember all these kids in the theater started crying. Parents yep. walking up pissed off, like, that's not a kid's movie. They, no, it's not.
Yeah, because it came over to the States by Disney, didn't it?
Mm-hmm, yes.
And they got all these, in my opinion, horrible voice actors for it that did not fit the setting at all, except maybe Gillian Anderson as the wolf god. But I had seen it originally dubbed, or not dubbed, with subtitles,
mm-hmm.
like on VHS, and my family had watched it, so... we knew what the movie was, and yeah, they had like a showing of it. We went there, looked around, and said, what the hell are all these families and kids doing here? You know? So, yeah. So anyway, back to your thing. Like, correct me if I'm wrong, Chris, but doesn't something else have to happen to the individual in addition to just being really angry for them to turn into like a demon or to get something? So it's not like they just like Hulk out anytime they want. Like,
in the case of the movie, yes, you're right. Specifically the main character, Ashitaka, he was not possessed by a demon, but he had kind of a demon's essence inside him that he was fighting against.
Right, he kind of got like corrupted, and I remember like the big boar god, like he got shot and was like really wounded. So I think, yeah, that's kind of the other stuff there as well.
If you look at it more closely, it's where the demons were constantly trying to manifest, and it was more the self-control that kept them in, but when they got angry or too emotional, then they lost that control a little bit, and the power came out.
Right. You could do that, like, the name Rage Mage aside, right? Like, you could do that with any type of character, mm-hmm. right? So long as the idea is it's this kind of demon fueling your abilities or powers, you know? Because I could see, like, you know, a really skilled swordsman who is that good because of, you know, some evil influence.
Well, you have kind of the berserker mechanic built into various kind of barbarian classes, that kind of thing. But I don't know, we talked about it for a while. We were talking about making our own system around that mechanic, but we never thought of a really good way to make it work, mechanically specifically, because it's too hard to say, you know, unless you are emotional yourself, to say that my character is getting really emotional. It's hard to maybe not overuse that in a situation. I think it's kind of like the White Wolf Mage series. You know, if you have a lot of really good role players and who kind of honestly go into the system, then that's fantastic, you know. They treat the system as if it were realistic. But it's far too easy to game the system. You know, you can make an explosion and say, oh yeah, there's a gas main underneath, therefore I take no
Paradox.
Paradox, yeah. Thank you very much. So I think you could make the idea work, but we never actually figured out a way to make it work.
I guess you'd have to do a system similar to, like, the D&D Barbarian, where they get the bonuses, but then there is a downside.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can still game the system. And I mean, you can game any system.
True.
But you could do it with, like, mana points or power points or whatever the system is, and they get that much. They get a surge of 20, so they can just cast more, I suppose.
Yeah.
Then there's a downside. Perhaps it hits them physically. It drains them.
Yeah.
They could even pass out.
Yeah, definitely take physical damage back.
There's something as well, is that they're trading hit points or SDC or whatever. Mm. Obviously, you can see I'm reading up on riffs.
You're playing an SDC character? Crazy, man.
Yeah. Yeah, and you trade that off for power points, so...
Yeah,
I think it is possible. In a sense, the sorcerer can be an emotional mage.
Hmm. Yeah.
You know, something that you might want to read is the Green Lantern comics that came out maybe a couple years ago in Blackest Night, where they produced all these different colored lanterns, and you have the Lanterns of Rage. And
yeah, actually, I borrowed that series from you. I only got about halfway through it, I think. But yeah, it was very, very good.
Yeah.
Sounds pretty cool. Well, I was going to say, like, three systems actually come to mind, because I agree, Chris, you would have to tie it mechanically to the system, because otherwise, yeah, it's really difficult to role-play emotion, or, you know, some people just kind of don't do it. But, like, when you said White Wolf, I immediately thought of Vampire, and how, like, the fear tests and the hunger tests are tied to how many, blood points you have. And that's not the same thing as emotion, but that definitely affected, you know, how easy it was for you to pass the test and when you had to make them. So, you know, if you tied it to something mechanically, that would be a way to do it. And then I thought of Marvel Heroic Roleplaying, where you have an emotional stress track, you know, and you can take emotional stress, you know, from being insulted or, you know, belittled or, you know, called out, stuff like that. So you would definitely want or need to have a system that tracked emotional damage somehow. Mm-hmm. Or, because, like, even Savage Worlds, right, that you can kind of have emotional damage where, you know, every system has, not every system, but lots of systems have insult or, you know, interrogate or bluff or whatever those. And usually they just kind of, you know, let you get past a guard or get you the information you want, but skills along those lines could actually do damage, or not even necessarily do damage, but, you know, get people points to fuel their whatever special abilities they have.
It could be a really cool kind of balance if you did that, because if you can emotionally damage somebody or manipulate somebody, then you're actually manipulating their power source as well. That could be a lot of fun.
Yeah, because even Marvel Heroic Roleplaying, like, one of the things that, well, we didn't play it that much, but one of the things you could do was, if you had stress on you, you could actually add it to your die pool as a benefit, then you had to return it stepped up. You know, like, you actually made yourself closer to getting stressed out and taking out of the scene, but you could use your own stress, you know, as an idea like, okay, I have to do this, and then, you know, just go. But you guys said, like, doing damage to yourself and getting knocked out, that made me think of All for One, that Musketeer horror ubiquity setting, where their magic system was really freeform, and you just kind of kept taking a cast a magic spell action until you acquired enough successes to fire off the ritual. But what they said is, when you rolled the dice a number of times equal to your, like, casting level, like if your magic skill was like 4, every time the dice hit the table 4 times, you took damage. And it's just because, like, you are channeling magical energy and you're just not able to channel that much. So it let pretty much anyone of any magic ability cast any spell, but at a pretty big price, you know? Like, if you're like, well, I'm only going to roll this so many times, I'm going to take a lot of damage because I have to roll so often, you know, to get this out. But, again, the interesting thing was they said, even if you like, successfully cast a spell, but still take damage on that turn that knocks you out, the spell still goes off. Or if you have enough people together, you know, you can share that damage out between all the people who are participating in this ritual. So
that's pretty cool.
Like, there are systems out there that have something similar or have, like, bits and pieces for inspiration. But I don't think there's any, or at least I haven't seen one, that is the Rage Mage kind of package all in one thing.
I think there's, wasn't there something in D&D?
There was, like, the Berserker thing.
No, there's different.
I'm sure there's a prestige class somewhere.
Yeah, does it have that cooler name?
Rage Mage!
Rage Mage? No, that's all you, man. All you.
No, I was thinking Fate might be kind of a way to go, you know, since we discussed doing this podcast, and I was thinking about it, because you have the aspects for it. So, I don't know, it might be a little bit too, putting it too mechanical or too gamey, but if you had something like an aspect as your trigger, these are the kind of situations that set you off, that provoke an emotional response from you. And then when those situations would come up, you would, I don't know, either gain power from them or would somehow affect what the power is. But then it would kind of tell, the GM would kind of be forced to bring up those situations, you know, because that's part of the character, it's part of the integration into the game. So I don't see it would work for a very long-term game, but yeah, I don't know.
Well, again, wasn't Dresden one of the games that had emotional stress track?
It does. So, and that's, I thought that was one of the, well, sorry, no, it doesn't have emotional, it has social, but that kind of counts as emotional.
Well, I'll go next. My inspiration actually is recent, although it's a rather old comic, and it's Swamp Thing. When that comic was written by Alan Moore. And it's around about the time where it was the first appearance of John Constantine.
Okay.
So if people don't know, Swamp Thing is the plant elemental who's very powerful in the DC universe, and John Constantine is the occultist, I guess somewhat sorcerer, wizard, who's a bit of an anti-hero in the DC or Vertigo universes. And issue 37 of the second volume of Swamp Thing was John Constantine's first appearance. And right after that, in issue number 38, was a story about vampires. Now, I was never really interested in Swamp Thing, but I just picked these up at a bookstore. They had the trade paperbacks in Japan on sale, just giving them away. So I thought, well, I'll pick it up. And it turned out, oh, John Constantine, I do like him. But then I started to read them. I was like, wow, it's some good stuff. And it's more of a setting inspiration. And what they have is they have this abandoned old town that is abandoned because it got flooded. So vampires live in this town. So they're underwater because they're protected from the sun all day. And these are actually vampires who are affected by running water, so it's all still water.
Oh, okay.
So some systems, they don't have the running water disadvantage. But just the idea of course, you know, playing vampires like that. I mean, there's two things you can go, vampires going underwater more. But just the idea of You're taking a regular setting, like a small town, an abandoned town, and just put it underwater, and it would just make it that much more exciting.
Well, it is pretty exciting. That makes me think of one of the Vampire Masquerade books I picked up here. And again, it was like really cheap. It was like almost like a... probably around like a buck. But it was, I think, Havens of the Damned, where they looked at like 7 or 9 kind of vampire havens, and one of them was just an underwater crate, you know, off of a dock somewhere. And they're like, look, I think it was a Gangrel, so the guy didn't really care what his place looked like. It was just, you know, a place to live when the sun went up. And they're like, yeah, vampires don't need to breathe. So you can live pretty much anywhere. So why not just submerge yourself, you know, in this crate under a dock, and nobody knows you're there because nobody goes down there. And then when, you know, you wake up, just pull yourself up by a chain, dry yourself off, and you're good to go. So
you'd have to keep some dry clothes in a footlocker nearby or something, but still, that's really cool.
Well, I mean, if you're one of those, like, fancy vampires who, like, actually goes into a building to feed, well then, yeah, if you're just like, hey, some dock hobos, good enough. It doesn't really matter.
I mean, they took it a step further. They were, like Constantine's explaining, that, you know, vampires, you know, they've always existed, but they're very scattered because they have to be, because they have to, come the daytime, they gotta go on hide.
Right.
But once they have this community where they're all underwater, they don't need to hide so much anymore, and they can actually congregate. And then when they congregate, it means they can now breed. So the idea of them not breeding wasn't because of any physical inability. It was just because they would never congregate, because it was dangerous to do so.
Breed as in, like, birth new vampires or, like, gather people?
Birth new vampires.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, no, it was just that small little shift. And it just kind of, it really opened things up. And, like Chris says, you could even make it... It could be like that solo. If we're just doing vampires, you could do the solo guy who, or girl who's just has their haven underwater. But then you could have an entire community underwater. And then how would that change the way they interact? Or you could do, I saw, when I was in Myanmar, I saw a movie with the typhoon. I think it was called Bait. It's a shark film, and it was just... This was before Sharknado.
Right.
So it hadn't yet reached a singularity.
Yeah, so it was still at the, how do we get the sharks into the supermarket? And there was the typhoon.
Which makes a little more
sense. No, tidal wave.
Oh, tidal wave. That makes even more sense. All right.
Yeah, I was like, I'm hearing myself say typhoon. It doesn't sound right. So there's a big tidal wave. I think this was right after the tidal wave, where was that? Maldives? Thailand?
Ah, yeah, I remember the one. Yeah, that was in Thailand.
Yeah. So, it was, you know, playing off of that, and then there's like a supermarket and a parking garage, and then they just put it all underwater. And now, of course, they just have a shark going through, but there's a lot of stuff you could do with that, and that was pretty cool. If you wanted to have a sudden, let's make everything underwater, of course, bam, tidal wave.
Right.
Now, what do people do? And how to improvise. Or you could do, you know, the abandoned ruins, put them underwater. You know, that much more exciting.
Well, it's also like, it's exciting because of what it does, or what it allows the vampires to do, you know, like congregate and kind of avoid from the sun to be out in the open. But it's also something interesting for the players to deal with. You know, like, I don't know, you think of like a dungeon crawl, right? And it's pretty straightforward. But then you put the dungeon underwater, and you're like, wow, okay, how are we going to deal with this? And everything's different. And, you know, you're not limited to moving along a flat plane anymore. You can actually swim around and, you know, enter buildings on like second floor. And, hey, guns aren't going to work because you're underwater. And
hey, and it's a dungeon crawl. We don't have guns.
Well, all right, all right.
I skipped over that.
I'm kind of I'm jumping around here, but you get my point.
This M16 ain't gonna work because
we're in a dungeon crawl. What? I gotcha. All right.
No, actually, when I was on the same page with that movement thing, the 3D movement. I remember, I think it was Eclipse Phase, where one of the planets was, it was an ice planet that had been melted, the interior, so the entire planet was built underwater.
That's probably Io, like the one of the moons of Io, yeah.
Maybe Europa or something.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's what it was, Europa, sorry.
But regardless, they really played up that idea that there isn't back and forth, right and left movement, that it's completely a 3D environment. So doors can be on the ceiling or, underneath or on all sides, whatever. And I think that kind of 3D movement could really be a lot of fun to play with, especially if your characters maybe didn't expect it. So they kind of go in and they're going straight along the regular parallel lines and stuff is coming from them above and below. They'd probably learn pretty quick, but...
A game like Eclipse Phase would be really good for that, because then you can actually have the people sleeve into these bodies that can live underwater.
Mm-hmm.
If you just wanted to focus on the 3D aspect, as opposed to, hey, I'm drowning.
Can't breathe.
Right.
Yeah. You want to shift
the
focus
in that game.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, one of the most exciting action scenes or scenes ever in James Bond films was what? That was Thunderball? It's all underwater, and they got the spear guns.
Oh, yeah.
The Spectre, and you're just, that's amazing. And they got these spear guns, and you take the spear guns out of the water, and that's pretty lame. But underwater, that's amazing. And, yeah, like, people can come at you from all these different angles. And I think, yeah, no, that's a really good point, Chris. That 3D aspect can make it cool. And again, like what Wayne was touching on, what I was saying about the small town or in the regular dungeon, mm-hmm. if you put it into an environment that people are normally used to in a dry setting, then that makes the 3D aspect even better, because you're kind of going to try to walk down the town normally, and
right.
people are just coming at you from the top.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't think that'd be... On the one hand, that'd be, like, really cool, and hopefully your players would get it. You're like, and there's a vampire coming down you from the third time from that rooftop. So, like, why don't you guys look up once in a while, or swim up or do something? You
know? I take my 10-foot pole, and now I stick it up in the air.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I'd go even one step further. Like, if you had a modern setting where a city was underwater, I'd take one of the, I suppose, dungeons it would be, take a skyscraper and tip it over so that it's parallel to where you would be going, but you still have to worry about the up and down side of it. So you'd have to go forward to find a stairwell that would lead you up instead of forward. Oh, that'd be so much fun.
Unless you were trying to map it. And you're like, son of a bitch.
True.
This doesn't fit on my graph paper.
Oh, and I always find it cool. It was in, like, The Day After Tomorrow. Or I forget what else.
One of them Frozen disaster movies.
You see, like, a... I wasn't just thinking Frozen disaster movies, but, they see the plane in the building. Maybe it was Fist of the North Star or something. There's a plane in the skyscraper, or there's a boat in the middle of nowhere.
Or there's a car sticking out of a wall in a restaurant. Awesome.
Yeah. Isn't that like a theme, 50s theme?
Yeah, that's what I was going at.
Oh, okay.
Lame joke. All right.
Okay.
Please continue.
Yeah. So, yeah, you could just stick things anywhere, like, just because, hey, why is it there? Hey, the tidal wave moved it there. Oh, okay.
Hopefully it'll be a little bit more exciting than that.
Yeah, all right. Okay, well, there's a plausible explanation. I'm no longer shocked.
Wait, why is it that tidal wave? No, why is that a tidal wave? Dude, just, he'll say tidal wave for everything.
Why is there a cactus in this room?
Tidal wave.
A tidal, ooh.
Yeah. Yeah. But we're making characters for Chris's... Pathfinder game, and I have a rogue, and wow, you can really take all the skills.
Oh, really?
And yeah, and you still don't want to put too many skill points in swim. You're like, oh, I'll never use it. But then you play underwater. Hey, you're gonna regretting that now.
Yeah.
How do you know you're not gonna use that swim skill?
Huh? Yeah, Chris may be one of those GMs like, okay, let me see your catch. Okay. So you start off in a boat. And you fall in. Oh, what's that? No swim? Oh, yeah, sorry.
You're drowning in the sea. What do you do? Nothing, because you don't have swim.
Yeah.
Very fun, Chris. The end. All right. And Wayne, you had an idea?
Yeah. After watching Pacific Rim, I came home and watched a good movie, which was Cloverfield.
And that's a great movie. I really enjoyed that.
I forgot how great of a disaster movie that is. You're just like, no explanation, stuff's just happening. And that gave me the inspiration for found footage. And I guess this one's a little bit different, where it's more of a way for the GM to, I guess, present things. Because, mm-hmm. I don't know, part of what made Cloverfield such a great disaster movie is both you, the audience, and the characters in the movie do not know what the heck is going on. And there's no time to explain stuff. And I think that would make... Well, one, it would make a great mystery game. Because so often in games, there has to be kind of an explanation for why things are there or why the mystery is happening. And, yeah, in like a detective story, you kind of want to get to the end and you want to solve that mystery. But, I don't know, sometimes I think that not solving the mystery can be just as interesting, and you don't really know what's going on. You just have to react. So that's why that movie seems like a great disaster movie. But the first-person perspective, right? Watching that or watching another kind of quote-unquote found footage film, such as like Troll Hunter, which is another good movie, or like Blair Witch, I really thought about how to present the scene to the players. I think we often, as game masters, lose perspective, literally, and describe things in either like a bird's eye view or with giving PCs kind of the ability to kind of notice everything that's going on around them, when that's not really what would happen. Presenting stuff kind of directly to the character that they would see, I think, is one kind of piece of inspiration to take from that. But you can also do other stuff with found footage. Like, people have talked about doing like prequels before. I think it'd be pretty cool to run a game, a short game, and then start another campaign with the found footage being the game you just played. I mean, it would take a little bit... Alright, thank you, Neil. It would take a little bit of a setup. And I don't really know how you would do it without giving the idea away to the players, because as soon as you kind of say, okay, well, we're going to play this game, and it's going to affect the second game, but I can't really tell you how. You know, I see that as being kind of difficult to set up.
Wow, there's a lot there.
The perspective?
Yeah. Or not necessarily the perspective, but using a short campaign that then becomes sort of like found footage for the main campaign. Or even like a session.
Well, for what it's worth, my woe was genuine, despite being Keanu Reeves. I'd never thought of that idea before, and I think that's really, really cool. As far as how to do it, I would just record the first session and then take snippets that I liked or that I wanted to present, and present them as, I don't know, found footage, found audio recordings or video recordings to the second session. You know, if maybe record the last part of the battle where somebody yells out, he's really big, he's this monster, we gotta kill it, or something like that, and then present to the players, maybe if the premise is a mundane setting, but, you know, there are people talking about fighting monsters, you know, what does this all mean? And you're right, it would be hard, it would take a lot of suspension of disbelief, because the same players would have played the previous session, so they know what they were fighting and what happened. But if you presented it, again, if you kind of changed up the setting to it where it didn't mesh with what the previous setting was, then it could open a lot of questions.
Well, I hadn't even thought of actually like recording the session as either like, and then presenting audio snippets. But I was kind of thinking of something similar to what you did when we tried playing Savage Worlds, which was the sort of like the flashback or the dream sequence that we all had.
Mm-hmm.
Because yeah. I think that there's a bit more buy-in or interest or excitement when characters actually play or get to be directly involved in the exposition that they get. You know, because you could just totally, if you're doing like the found footage thing, you could totally narrate or describe or have a note of what the players see on this tape or hear on the audio recording or the dream they have. But, you know, role-playing games are interactive, so why not have them interact and actually be the characters that is on that piece of found footage? And A, you're going to get to play the game, which hopefully will be fun. B, yeah. I think if done well, the players will be more invested or at least more interested in that hook that the found footage represents because they got to experience it, you know, for lack of a better term.
I'll add a caveat to that, and that was the problem specifically with when I attempted it, is that I didn't make it clear enough that it was, in fact, a vision or found footage, as the case may be, and everybody was kind of confused as to why they suddenly switched characters.
Yeah, I think what happened is we also, you did it right at the beginning, where we were kind of expecting to, okay, you know, we made our characters, getting ready, expected to play, and... Huh? We're not? Okay.
Yeah.
So
here's these other characters you're going to play.
Yeah, I don't know if I would do it right at the beginning. You know, I think I'd kind of play the normal game, and then whenever this found footage thing needs to come up, you know, actually play that session, and then say, and okay, that's what you see on the thing.
The thing is about found footage is when you're using a movie like Cloverfield or Blair Witch, it's the whole thing is the found footage.
Right.
It's not as if, I mean, there's no examples. I mean, I'm not saying that therefore don't do it, but there's no examples, I suppose, people finding a tape and then doing something else. Well, I suppose there are movies, but there weren't the found footage movies. They were just people find a tape and then do something with it movies. So, I don't know. I guess it would have to be a point, but yeah, certainly the adventure couldn't be too long for the found footage
right.
if they know it's going to just be used for something else.
Right.
And there's also the danger of the players knowing everything that's going to happen, so it does take away a little bit of their mystery. Yeah. I mean, if you had the ideal situation, you actually have two gaming groups.
Right.
One gaming group becomes the found footage for the other gaming group.
Right.
I think, yeah, that's a very valid point, because if you reveal too much in the found footage session, well, then the mystery is solved for the main campaign. You know, they're like, oh, well, we know exactly what we have to do. So, I guess you could either use that, you know, and have the found footage session be pretty much the last clue they needed. You know, it just kind of solidifies, okay, we were right. Now let's go deal with this thing. Or the other way to do it, and again, it would take not a lot of work, but a kind of a skilled GM, is much like Cloverfield. Like, you still don't know what happened in that movie, really. Because, as you said, Lyle, there's no afterwards, you know? It's just like that the found footage is the beginning and end of that movie. But if you could do kind of the in-between session where it didn't answer any questions, really. It just kind of either showed them how dangerous this thing is or gave them some small clue or just, I don't know, kind of let them experience, you know, what, well, not what the victim went through, because that sounds really creepy, but if it just kind of gave them an impression of what they were dealing with rather than solving all their questions, I think it could work as well. And again, that would take some skill, because as we all know, players, they don't let go of a mystery. So if they have a question, they're like, we're going to get to the end of this. And you're like, oh, what is it? So.
Yeah, actually, that was the point that I was going to bring up, is when you mentioned that Cloverfield kind of leaves everything open. We kind of talked about this back in the endings episode previously, but you'd have to be careful. I think a lot of players would want closure in an adventure. And if they didn't receive it, they might... either A, just kind of write it off as not being that interesting, or B, just, you know, be angry at you for leaving it open like that.
Well,
I think we did discuss in the endings episode where then you could pick it up later.
Yeah, like cliffhanger kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, and that would be the one where, you know, if people want to know what happens next,
right?
Then do it. I mean, Cloverfield might be one of the ones. I don't want to reveal the ending, but. Certainly there are stuff that you could do, not necessarily with that group, but they find that, and somehow there are clues to, let's say, a monster's weakness or where a monster might be hiding and that.
I think that might actually make that whole thing work, is if you did a short adventure where it was that cliffhanger ending where there was nothing answered, it was just kind of this horrific running from monsters kind of thing, and then the second adventure is where you're playing, maybe fighting back against that monster or monsters, and you have to use information that you got from the first session, either presented like as flashbacks or if you had recordings of it or something like that, use those clues to try and figure out what was going on.
Well, maybe I didn't make myself clear, because that's kind of what I was thinking. Like, I was never really intending the players to play the same character in both the found footage and the main game. It's kind of like, nope, you're now playing these characters for this, you know, really short session that ends on a cliffhanger that provides clues for the main campaign. And now we're going to go back to the main campaign rather than me,
a lot of fun, yeah.
You know, again, rather than me saying this is what you find, we're going to play it. And hopefully that will get you a little more interested and invested in solving the mystery that this found footage tape provides.
I mean, I kind of take that as advice in general for most of the games that I run. If there's anything that the players can play, I prefer that they do play it. For example, the church fight back in the Red Hands campaign. And, the situation for the audience was there was, the players were off on another side of the campaign world doing their mission. But at the same time, the evil bad group was gonna fight against the good group so that when the players came back, they would see what happened. I split up the group and had half of the group fight the other group. One is the good guys, one is the bad guys, to see what would happen. It's just, I think you should involve the players in any part of the story that you possibly can.
Right, and that's kind of why I brought up, like, the found footage thing, because, it was playing in that was a lot better than being told what happened.
Yeah, totally. And then people remember it, too, far better than if you just told them about
it. Exactly. And that's exactly right. Like, people remember it. However, like, our characters didn't really have any way of knowing exactly what happened.
Oh, yeah, I didn't want you to.
No, but I mean, like, even the fight, we kind of wouldn't have known. Well, I guess we would have known about, you know, the fight, but we wouldn't have known what happened during it, which you just kind of, like, hand wave because you're playing. But that's why I kind of thought of the found footage. It's like, no, we actually have video, you know, footage of what happened. And so that's why you can kind of play it, and it doesn't really seem out of place. So.
Cool.
All right, well, that's the end of our first inspiration. So we have something from Princess Mononoke, Swamp Thing, and Cloverfield.
All right, well, thank you for joining us on Idle Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idleredhands.com, idleredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website, or stream it through iTunes or Stitcher, or download it off of DriveThruRPG. You can also follow us on Twitter, or like us on Facebook, or just send us an email and talk to us, because we'd love to hear from all of you guys. Thanks a lot, and see you next time.
Bye.
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 DriveThruRPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week, and we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. DriveThruRPG, the one true source for RPGs.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.